Hello. It's December 19th, 2024. My name is Simone, and this is 90s Crime Time. Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time. And if you're new to 90s Crime Time, welcome to the show. Like always, I hope you all have had a great week so far and are preparing for the upcoming weekend. I'll go ahead and say listener's discretion is advised. Because today's episode has to deal with gang violence, a lot of gang violence. And if you want to really follow along with this episode, I suggest you get a pen and paper because today's episode is going to be a lot. And I'll go ahead and apologize for any mispronunciations I do of names. And with that, let's dive in to today's case. The year was 1998, and in Vancouver, Canada, one of the country's most populated cities, many named it one of the most picturesque settings of any city in the world. You see, in Vancouver, many people loved the beautiful, snow-capped mountains surrounding Vancouver during the winter season. And even during the warmer months, many could view Vancouver's stunning sunsets. Vancouver was also known as one of the most cosmopolitan cities in Canada and worldwide due to its entertainment districts, high technology firms, and modern shopping. Also, Vancouver was revered for being a melting pot for different cultures with people from all over the world living here. However, a report states that around the late 1980s, many citizens of Vancouver became concerned when reports of several murders around the city occurred that primarily had to do with gang violence. And when one reputed gang leader was gunned down during the holiday season of 1998, many people in Vancouver would be scared and wonder if the violence would ever stop. In the following case, you'll find out who the victim was, the investigation, and the shocking aftermath in a case I title Eliminated. On the night of December 19th, 1998, around 300 young people crowded into the popular Club Palladium in Vancouver on that cold winter night. As booze was flowing and people were dancing the night away into the early morning hours of December 20th, at around 2 a.m., the crowd was still going crazy, until suddenly a loud bang rang out into the crowd. And then people on the dance floor noticed an unidentified man flee from the club. And then many saw the horrible sight of another man lying on the ground, bleeding from his head. And after being rushed to the hospital, the man died from his wound 4 hours later. And he was identified as 27-year-old, notorious Vancouver resident Bhupinder Bindi Joal. Reports state Bhupinder, nicknamed Bindi Joal, was born on January 14, 1971, in Punjab, India, to devout Jat Sikh parents. And although it's unclear if he had siblings, from all accounts, Bindi was born into a family that loved him. When he was 4, Bindi's parents moved with Bindi to Vancouver, Canada, where his mother got a job as a secretary and his father as a mill worker. Not much is reported on his childhood, but Bindi seemed to be your average child growing up. His peers thought he was friendly enough, and his teachers thought he was your average student. However, when he hit his preteen years, by 1984, Bindi started to change. You see, that year, the Indian leader Indira Gandhi was assassinated by her own bodyguards. And the bodyguards happened to be of the same faith as Bindi's family. Due to this, many Sikhs around the world were assaulted in revenge for the attack on Miss Gandhi, including Bindi. Reports state that sometime in 1984, the now preteen Bindi was attacked during an armed assault, presumably by a Gandhi supporter. In response, Bindi, who then wore a turban and had long hair underneath at that time, was forced to stop wearing his turban and told to cut his hair by his parents, angering him and sending him into a deep depression. After he was forced to do this, Bindi apparently took out his anger on anyone, including his family and at school. One report states that although Bindi maintained good grades at school, he frequently defied authority and argued with teachers and school administration. Another report states that once, by 1989, when Bindi and a vice principal got into a heated argument about Bindi's behavior, Bindi beat him to the point of life-threatening injuries, and he was arrested. Bindi was then expelled from his high school, and when he was on trial for the crime, Bindi took the stand and said he only did it because he was a victim of a racist society. However, the judge rejected his defense and sentenced Bindi to 60 days in jail. After his sentence, Bindi moved with his family to another location to finish high school, where this time he kept it mostly together behavior-wise, although he did smash in the window of a car using a baseball bat and was convicted of possession of a dangerous weapon. After graduating high school, he did attend college, but only for one semester before dropping out. And by this time, in his adulthood, Bindi wanted to follow a different path in life, a dangerous one. Reports state Bindi was still filled with anger, and he knew that he had to make his way in life with money, and he wanted to be his own boss. So, Bindi reached out to an old friend from his first high school named Faisal Dean, who was a member of the Los Diablos street gang, and inquired with him on how to become a member of the gang. Reports state Los Diablos was a mid-level criminal organization that sold drugs on the streets of Vancouver and carried out the violent contract work that some larger gangs avoided. Los Diablos formed in the 1960s, mostly of Latino members. But by the time the late 80s rolled around, many Southeast Asian men, mostly of Indian descent, took the gang over, and shortly after Bindi was accepted into the gang's name was changed to the Punjab Mafia. And the leaders at that time were brothers Ron and Jimmy Dosanjh. Bindi and Faisal's jobs in the gang were to sell cocaine, which meant something to Bindi because the Dosanjh brothers had massive street cred, and the brothers and the gang as a whole were respected due to being feared. However, by 1991, when Jimmy was arrested for the murder of a Colombian cocaine trafficker named Teodoro Saucedo, Bindi knew Ron wouldn't hold as much power as he would have had with his brother, so he decided to take the proceeds he made from drug dealing, and in a gutsy move, along with Faisal, they bought cocaine in bulk and sold the drugs in competition against Ron and the rest of the Punjab Mafia. And the two men did so well that many of the Punjab Mafia started to gravitate towards Bindi and Faisal. And soon enough, the men were raking in loads of money and were gaining their own reputation, good and bad. which angered Ron. But to Bindi, he and Faisal were rising to the top of the drug world. But the dynamic changed again when an event on October 12, 1991, threatened to end it all. Reports state that on that night, Faisal made a phone call to a fellow criminal named Praminder Chanda, age 21, who he was running a credit card scam ring with. Even though it said Faisal and Praminder had a decent working relationship, by October of that year, it weakened after Faisal's friend, Rajinder Binji, told Faisal that Praminder had been seeing Rajinder's underage cousin, which angered Rajinder, and he wanted revenge. This also bothered Faisal, so the two came up with a plan. On October 12th, Faisal called Praminder and told him they needed to meet because police had uncovered their credit card scam and suggested they meet at the salvage yard where Praminder worked. When Praminder met up with Faisal, Rajinder was also there to meet him. And when Praminder arrived, Faisal immediately grabbed him, held him down, and Rajinder stabbed him 53 times to his death. 2 days later after the murder, Parminder's girlfriend, Rajinder's cousin, 17-year-old Jaswinder Binji, jumped to her death because she was so hurt by the murder. However, by this point, Faisal and Rajinder had not been named as suspects. But as they tried to lay as low as possible after the murder for months, they remembered talking about the murder around their fellow gang member, Sanjay Narain, in December 1991. And he was known to have a big mouth. Panicked, they went to Bindi about what to do. Well, on December 2nd, 1991, Sanjay was called to Vancouver's Cleveland Dam for an alleged drug deal. However, when he arrived, a witness reported a tall figure emerged and pointed a gun at Sanjay's head. And the next morning, his body was found in the nearby river. However, he hadn't been shot. He'd been thrown off a bridge. And although Sanjay's case became a cold case, many believed Bindi was behind the murder, as he didn't want to lose his right-hand man, Faisal, to prison. But no one ever came forward to accuse him. However, a few weeks after Sanjay's murder, a tip came in naming Faisal and Rajinder as Parminder's killers. During the investigation, police talked anonymously with some suspects, and it was eventually Faisal's girlfriend who ratted them out and said Faisal even bragged about the killing. Eventually, both men were arrested and charged with Parminder's murder, with Rajinder, who actually did the stabbing, acquitted, and Faisal, who set it up, found guilty of second-degree murder and sentenced to life without the possibility of parole for 12 years. Without Faisal, Bindi was angry, but he didn't let it stop him from carrying on with the empire. Reports state that within a year, Bindi was raking in more millions, living lavishly, and was wooing several different women, all due to his newly formed drug empire. Reports state, though, Bindi was flashy and was rumored around town to be involved in a murder. Police began to follow him. However, it didn't matter to Bindi. He knew he was being watched and felt he should give them a show. He would reportedly hang out all around Vancouver's nightlife scene, hoping to run into police because if they tried him, he knew they'd have nothing on him. He also paraded around town to mock his rivals. And speaking of rivals, just as Bindi's empire was really growing, Jimmy Dosange was released from prison after his charges were dropped for the murder of Teodoro Salcedo. But when he was released, he grew angry after realizing Bindi's empire was becoming bigger than his, especially after he taught him what he knew. And now that he was out of prison, he wanted to become king again. Reports state Jimmy paid a hitman to remove his competition, aka Bendy, and the plan was set for Bendy's hit in February 1994. However, an emergency call came to the police on February 25th about a man's dead body in an alley at 33rd and Fraser. When police went to the scene, they identified the deceased man as Jimmy Dosange, and he had been shot and killed. Police believed the killer was Bendy as they got word Jimmy was trying to regain his top spot as a drug kingpin in Vancouver, but they could not find any evidence to tie him to the murder. But that didn't stop the police from looking at him as a possible suspect. They even went to the press to name Bendy as a person of interest, and in return, Bendy went to the press and sat down with a TV reporter. After being questioned, Bendy said in part, quote-unquote, "This Jimmy Dosange. They portrayed him as a hitman, this, that. Personally, from what I've seen of him on the street, I don't think he could have hit his way out of a paper bag." After his interview, a TV crew went to Ron's home to get a response, and he said to the camera he'd shoot Bendy between his eyes. Then yet again, Bendy went back on TV and said in part, quote-unquote, "Basically, I just want these guys to know, you got another thing coming, bitch. I'm still here." After his second interview, Bendy's arrogance riled up many of his rivals. And in the weeks after Jimmy's murder, there were several reported drive-by shootings, nightclub shootings, and shootings in the street with multiple victims. Then, things boiled over when on April 19th, 1994, Ron was gunned down in broad daylight at the corner of Fraser and Kingsway. And then all hell broke loose. 5 days after Ron's murder, a Vancouver resident named Greg Olson was walking dogs when he was gunned down by an AK-47. And while Mr. Olson was not affiliated with any gangs, he was associated with Bendy, as he was his neighbor. Reports state, after the Dosange brothers' murders, Bendy, even though he bragged about being innocent, knew the police were looking at him hard, so he stayed low in his home. However, he and Greg got along, and as he was in hiding, Greg offered to walk his dog. After his murder, police theorized a rival or rivals of Bendy recognized the dog and thought it was Bendy walking the dog, mistaking his identity. The same day as Greg's murder, reports state Vancouver Mayor Philip Owen put together a 150-man special unit to investigate the killings, and over $1 million were spent solving the crime. And after extensive work, on April 25th, 1994, Bendy Johal was charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder in connection with the Dosange brothers' murders, alongside Sarbit Gill, Rajinder Big Raj Bendy, Michael Kim Buddha, Sun News La, Preet Peter Sarbeach Gill, and Kim Phil Hosik, with the latter accused of being the actual trigger man. The judge in the case denied bail for Bendy due to public safety, but the rest of the accused were allowed bail for $100,000 each, in which they paid. Reports state that over the next 5 months, Crown prosecutors laid out their case, which included over 100 witnesses and mountains of wiretap evidence, and local news was covering the commotion almost every day, as many in Canada had not seen such violence and definitely not covered on the news. When the trial for the accused began in the summer of 1995, reports state the hearing went on without a hitch for weeks, until court officials noticed something. One of the jurors, 40-year-old Jillian Guess, was acting suggestive towards one of the accused, Preet Peter Sarbeach Gill. When the officers mentioned this to the judge warned Peter about his behavior, but he never reprimanded Jillian. Reports state there were no other public nuisances with the trial, and by October 1995, the jury came back with a verdict, not guilty on all counts, angering the court as well as many in the public. They just couldn't believe how none of the men could be acquitted, and now many wanted them, especially Bindi, dead. However, if Bindi was worried, again, he didn't show it. After the trial, he was back on the Vancouver streets, arrogantly taunting his rivals by continuing to send messages to them on the news. He also flashed his expensive outfits and paraded women around town again. His syndicate was also back to business by continuing to traffic drugs and allegedly being violent, as there were reports of a stabbing at a strip club, 3 drive-by shootings, and a pair of nightclub shootings, all tied to his gang. By 1996, as Bindi's profits continued to grow, he recruited more pushers, and by this year, one pusher of his bought some cocaine from the brother of a rival gang member named Randy Chan. After the pusher bought the cocaine, they realized the cocaine had been diluted, and Bindi thought Randy was trying him. So he caught up to Randy one day, beat him, and put him in the trunk of his car. Reports state that for the next 56 hours, Bindi drove around the city negotiating the terms of Chan's release. Randy's family eventually got word of this and called the police. Then the police immediately deployed 70 officers to recover Randy, because they felt if they didn't, a huge gang war would break out, especially since Randy's brother was a high-ranking member of a rival gang. Eventually, Bindi let him go, but he was arrested on a charge of unlawful confinement. Again, Bindi told the news confidently, quote-unquote, "I'll beat this one for sure." After he was put in jail to await the kidnapping trial, Bindi met a man named Bal Buttar. They started to talk, and after a while, Bindi started to like him and thought he could be a great asset to his organization. And he began to groom Bal for a position in the Department of the Elite, a crew of murderers whose sole job was to assassinate Bindi's enemies. Eventually, after a date was set for the kidnapping trial, Bindi was released on bail, and Bal was too, shortly after, for his crimes. Reports state that after Bindi was released and Bal was now in his gang, rival gang members again started dropping like flies. A report states as many as 25 to 30 people in the next year or so were murdered, including some of Bindi's own associates. One associate, 24-year-old Gurinda Singh Kunkun, was found murdered on October 21, 1997. Although his murder went unsolved, word around Vancouver was that Bindi ordered his murder after he thought Gurinder was trying to pull away from him, and that he may have been involved in the murder of Greg Olson for reasons unclear. However, after a while, Bal noticed Bindi would simply, allegedly, have people killed for no real reason other than jealousy. Bal confided in some people that on one occasion, Bindi made up a story about an associate holding out cash from the organization and ordered one of his associates to murder him. But in fact, the murder was ordered allegedly because Bindi was jealous about this associate dating a girl he liked. By 1998, though, Bindi got even more reckless, and anyone he felt offended by in the least was done for. Reports state that in the summer of 1998, Bal was out with friends, including a fellow associate named Derek Shankar, age 19. Sometime that night, Derek called Bindi to join them to have some fun. When Bindi declined, as he said he was too tired, Derek called Bindi a baby. When the crew arrived back at Bindi's home that night, Bendy came out the door and looked for Derek. When he saw Derek, he told him and Bal he wanted to go for a ride. The next morning, Derek's body was found under a bridge. He had been shot to death. Bendy was said to have been behind Derek's murder, but no one came forward to name him as a suspect. However, after Derek's murder, many in his gang felt this murder was a betrayal. Many considered Derek a good friend and thought that Bendy took it too far. But again, no one turned him in to the police. By November 1998, another one of Bendy's close associates, 22-year-old Roman Danny Mann, was murdered. Again, it was said around Vancouver that Bendy was behind this murder as well, this time because Danny openly said he wanted out of the gang, to which Bendy took offense. But yet again, no one turned Bendy into police. However, police suspected Bendy was behind all these murders and were actively trying to find a way to take him down. But just weeks after Danny's murder, Bendy himself was gunned down at the Palladium nightclub on December 20th, 1998, ending his reign of alleged terror. After his murder, though, many people crowded the streets of Vancouver to pay their respects to the fallen leader, despite his notorious life, with many in the Punjab Canadian community symbolizing Bendy as a person who, quote-unquote, sought criminal activity as a means of fast success and money, a glamorized lifestyle, and to counter racial discrimination and abuse with counter-violence. Despite the nearly 300 partygoers in the club that night, no one there that night could name an assailant. And eventually, Bendy's case went cold. Until years later, in 2004, when Bal Buttar gave an interview to the local newspaper, the Vancouver Sun. By now, the 28-year-old Bal was considered a quote-unquote former gangster due to now being completely blind and a quadriplegic after being shot in 2001. But he still had some things to say about his time as a gangster and Bendy's murder. According to reports, Bal, who in 2007 was charged with conspiring to kill a friend's husband in 2004, despite his disability, told a reporter that Bendy had it coming, especially after Derek Shankar's death. Bal had been close to Derek's family, and when Bal's brother Kelly, who would also lose his life to violence in 2001, came to him angry about Derek's murder, he said he told him he'd get revenge. He continued and said he paid an assailant $20,000 to kill Bendy, as everyone liked Derek. And Bal said he ordered an associate of Bendy to do the hit because Bendy was too reckless. And he said had he not set the hit, he was afraid Bendy would kill him. However, he added after Bendy was murdered, the gang quickly dismantled and almost all the members started their own gangs. And he confessed to being involved in many other murders. Bal eventually pleaded guilty to the 2004 conspiracy charge, but due to his health, a judge ruled that he served no jail time. The friend he had helped to set up the murder was found guilty and sentenced to 7 years. Bal Buttar died of an infection in 2011. And despite his confession of setting up Bendy's murder, Bal was never brought to justice for the crime due to his health. It's also unclear if Bendy's case is still open or if police are looking into any hitmen who may have killed him since Bal's confession. The story of Bendy Johal and his violent end comes from the sources of the Toronto Star, the Calgary Herald, the Vancouver Sun, and others I'll put in the notes. All right, so like I mentioned in the beginning, I told you all this would be a lot. I wasn't sure about during... Okay, let me go ahead and say this. I wasn't sure about, for the end of season 5, if I would do a story on another massacre / mass shooting or a serial killer. And then I realized, because I've done so many mass shootings this season with, you know, the McDonald's and the train and all a Long Island Railroad train massacre and others. But I realized, wait, Bendy, if he was behind all these murders, he himself could be classified as a serial killer. So here I am doing a possible serial killer episode. Anyway, I believe as far as Bendy, he could have done something else in life because he seemed smart. I'm not sure why he decided to do a literal life of crime. I know he was upset from his attack of being for his faith years ago when he was a young person. Well, he was young when he died, but like a student. I don't know if it's because he wanted fast cash and money. I know that he was considered an average student, but something I believe was there. He was intelligent enough to start his own crime organization, even though he may have stolen the ideas from the Desange brothers who built him up for the most part and taught him everything he knew. I don't know if he intended on doing something else in life, but I feel like Bendy was too deep into his gang world to ever really do anything else in life, in my opinion. He was flaunting on the news. He was taunting people, killing people, allegedly, his own friends. He was just reckless. And I'm not sure if Bal actually had Bendy killed, because it could have been anyone, because from the story, he made a lot of people mad. And Bal could have been covering for someone more senior or someone he may have actually been afraid of, although he may have actually done it as he was worried Bendy may kill him for reasons unknown. But Bendy did, like I said, have some right-hand men killed anyway, so what's not to say he would have gotten mad at Bendy, because he seemed kind of crazy, like tick tick boom, like anything, any small thing Bal could have done may have ticked off Bendy, and who knows? He may have ticked off Bendy. Again, the name's confused here. May have ticked off Bendy, and he could have had Bal taken out or killed Bal himself. I mean, he allegedly killed Derek Shankar because Derek was joking and called him a baby, and that ticked him off so much and offended him that he had Bal killed. And, well, not Bal, Derek killed, I apologize. For jokingly calling him a baby. So who knows? It could have just been tick, tick, boom. Like I said, it could have he wasn't afraid to kill anyone, is my moral of the story. Now, I'll go ahead and I'm going to change subjects real quick. Okay. There was, during the trial for the Desange brothers' murders, Jimmy and Ron, I mentioned briefly in the episode about a juror named Jillian Guess, who was flirting with a co-defendant, Bendy's brother in law, Peter, Surpreet, but they called him Peter Gill. Now, her case was very sensationalized in Canada and apparently in the US as well, because there was a Law and Order episode based off the case of Jillian, because reports state she was 40 years old and a single mother, and she was bored in her life. She was called to jury duty for the double murder trial. And she thought Peter was attractive. And so she started to flirt with him. And like I said, the court official saw it and for some reason told Peter to stop it and never told anything to Jillian at that time. I think Peter had flirted sort of back, but not like intensely as Jillian did. She continued anyway to flirt with Peter, but out of court. And they eventually got together, started a little romance, little sex, little dancing, dating. And she apparently, according to reports, asked him if she should try to leave the jury because she was so infatuated with him. And she told the press that she couldn't see straight when she was around Peter because she was that in love with him. But he told her to stay on the jury and to find him not guilty. Stay in the jury, find him not guilty, and pretty much to hell with anyone else, because, you know, he wanted to be found not guilty. And he wanted her to persuade the jurors about him to find him not guilty. And eventually, Peter and the other co-defendants, including Bindi, were found not guilty for the double murder of the brothers. But they continued to see each other, Peter and Jillian. And the police were suspicious after the acquittal because they were like, something's just not right. It's, you know, she can't do that. She can't be a juror up there with a defendant. But they continued to see each other outside of the acquittal, outside of court. And so the police got suspicious. They saw them dancing at a club. And then they went to their boss and they were able to ask for permission to put listening devices around Jillian's home and to bug her phone and tap her phone. And so on one conversation, they caught her talking to her loved ones about how she got romantically involved with Peter. And she said she was obsessed. And again, she said she couldn't see straight. And in 1991, she was charged with obstruction of justice. And the media had a frenzy about this. Like, Jillian, this 40-year-old woman, not that that's old at all, but they were like, oh, she's 40. Oh, she's old. She's flirting with someone 8 years younger than her. But now it's like, that's nothing nowadays. 40 and 32 is nothing. She was eventually found guilty and sentenced to 18 months, but served 3 months only in a minimum security prison they called Camp Cupcake. And yeah, the media just went wild with this one. And then Peter was also arrested and charged with obstruction of justice. He was found guilty and sentenced to 6 years in prison in 2001, possibly because he was an actual co-defendant in the original trial. And so I just brought that to you all because I was like, this is crazy. This Jillian Guest case is just crazy, along with Peter. And just not lighten up the mood, but just like how it was so ridiculous and how they had the media had a frenzy in Canada and she was prancing around the cameras. She loved the attention. She loved Peter's attention. She loved the media attention. She even called and thanked a journalist for covering her story because she thought they did well about her. And it's just a lot regarding all of this, the Punjab Mafia, Jillian, Peter, the murders. It was a lot, like I said. And that's it. Thank you for tuning in to this brand new episode of 90s Crime Time. And I hope this case, even though a lot, piqued your interest. If you would like, and you haven't already, please leave a rating, in a good way, hopefully, about 90s Crime Time. Even if you don't like the show, I would love a rating. Again, I'm still trying hard to improve the show and improve myself as a host. You can follow 90s Crime Time on Instagram, primarily on the weekends, where I post new 90s cases on the weekends. And yeah, stay safe and healthy, and I'll see you very, very soon for the season 5 finale of 90s Crime Time.